When you hear my question, there's definitely a reason for it. I am in service to the audience. I am a proxy for the audience. I see myself as a translator when I'm talking about, you know, what went wrong in the USA gymnastics scandal, or, you know, what Michelle Carter was thinking then.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast featuring conversations about film, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and today I'm going to be speaking with writer-director Aaron Lee Carr. Aaron Lee Carr is the director of multiple documentaries, including At the Heart of Gold, Inside the USA Gymnastics Scandal, and Mommy, Dead and Dearest. She's also the author of All That You Leave Behind, a memoir. Her newest film, I Love You Now Die, The Commonwealth vs. Michelle Carter, is available on HBO. For those who don't know, Michelle Carter, the subject of Carr's latest film, was a woman who, in 2014, encouraged her boyfriend Conrad Roy to commit suicide via text message. Roy's death and the ensuing trial made headlines all around the world. And I personally was fascinated by this case because it seemed to hit at the intersection of a lot of different and interesting legal questions. Can somebody be held guilty of encouraging someone to commit suicide? To what extent? And what if they use technology to do it? How does that factor in? Carr's movie, I Love You Now Die, does a great job of looking beyond the headlines and presenting much of the info of the case in an even-handed way. I was super thrilled to talk to Carr, and we chatted about a huge range of topics, including her favorite documentaries, how she broke into the industry, and the essential elements of a great true crime documentary. Before we get to that, I should let you know you can find more episodes of this podcast at culturallyrelevantshow.com. You can also email us at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. If you enjoy the show, I would so appreciate it if you could go to Apple Podcasts and leave a star rating or a review. It really does help a show like mine to stand out. And also, if you enjoy the episode, please consider posting about it on social media. Every little bit helps. All that said, without further ado, here's my conversation with Aaron Lee Carr, and stay tuned afterwards for my weekly recommendation.
I saw him text her all the time, but I didn't think that they had a relationship like that.
It's sort of impossible to understand what happened because it's so far from, you know, acceptable human behavior.
The trial of a Plainville woman accused of encouraging her friend to kill himself through text messages is now underway.
We're all left wondering what happened. Now we have this opportunity to see inside their minds.
One level of the conversation is a kid that's going to kill himself. And then there's another level that's a romantic fantasy.
Aaron Lee Carr, thanks so much for joining me today.
Absolutely.
So one thing I like to do is talk about breaking in stories. How did you break into the industry, the filmmaking industry?
I was a producer advice for about 3 years. I was able to make short form video content. And one of the films that I produced was a film called Click Print Gun. And it was about a guy that was 3D printing low receivers for AR-15s. And it was, you know, pretty dangerous, scary stuff, but at the sort of forefront of the technological invasion of our society. And so that got like 10 million views, I think, in the first week or something. And so I very pigheadedly was like, I know how to do this. I got this. And so I took informationals around town after I was fired from a job. I love 30 seconds in just talking about being fired. Mm. And I met a filmmaker named Andrew Rossi, and he is a celebrated documentary filmmaker. He's done Page One, A Year in the New York Times, you know, Bronx Gothic, Ivory Tower, all these different things. And so we were in a coffee shop. And I was asking, you know, should I work at The Guardian? Should I work at Frontline? Like, do you think they'll have me? And he was like, I think you should make your own movies. And nobody had ever said that to me. And I thought it was sort of preposterous because I needed health insurance. But he ended up introducing me to a woman named Sheila Nevins, who is the doc king.
Yeah, the head of documentary at HBO, right?
Yeah.
Let's rewind even further back, actually. You said you made this documentary advice. Like, what got you into that kind of storytelling, particularly video storytelling advice?
Yeah, I mean, I was mentored by my dad, David Carr, an amazing, incredible New York Times journalist. And something that he said over the course of our mentorship was find a beat and stick to it. And I was always interested in video. I was all excited. I couldn't do journalism because that was his deal and he was incredible at it. But, you know, I said, you know, video journalism, that's where it's at. And I gravitated towards the internet and technology because it was something that, you know, I think had a giant, big, crazy audience. And I just wanted to like think about stories. And I remember that, you know, if this could be my beat, I could find the stories and, you know, sort of, you know, proceed from there.
It reminds me actually, when you're talking about it, your father reminds me of like Yo-Yo Ma, the cellist, and his daughter is actually a violinist. And I remember talking with my cello teacher when I was in high school about why his daughter chose violin. And he said, well, can you imagine like being a cellist and Yo-Yo Ma's daughter? You know, like even if you were exceptional at it, people would say like, well, she's no Yo-Yo Ma. I think that's like, there's this idea, if your parents are exceptional at something, you're always kind of like living in their shadow of that thing that they're very good at. So you chose documentary filmmaking advice, and this gun documentary, which I've watched, it's excellent, is one of the first things that put you on the map. Like, how did that story come to you?
There's a woman named Faith Gaskins who worked at Vice, and I think she had seen an article about Cody Wilson, the subject, in the New York Times, and she had pitched it for the HBO show, and the advice on HBO show. And they're like, nah. And she's like, you know, I think this is sort of really up your alley. I haven't talked to Cody yet. Like, see if you can get him on board. And so I ended up reaching out to Cody and trying to forge a relationship. And so when I went out there, he lives in Austin, Texas. He's still there. I think there had been a ton of pieces that took this, you know, really terrified look at Cody Wilson, which I understand. But as a young person, I was in my early 20s then, I was able to sort of assemble a series of scenes where it really felt like you were with him and he was less on his guard. And so it ended up being a film that it was figuring out who this human was. Now, a lot of people might object to that. Like, why would you add a human flair to someone who wants to aid in the abetting of sort of destruction of human life? But I think that, you know, at the time, it was something that was really important to talk about. And here was a main person willing to sort of talk about it on the record.
Yeah, and I guess I'm curious, you know, this documentary came out 6 years ago or so, right? How have you felt about how the gun debate has evolved since then?
At the time, it felt like normal and okay, and that I wasn't doing anything wrong to add, you know, a profile of this person. But I look back at it now, and we're sort of giving him the action hero treatment. There's a roving camera. He looks very handsome. You know, we shoot weapons in the woods. And like, I would not do that now, man. Like, he and I have stayed in contact, you know, early on, but I don't think that you get to be glamorized for that kind of thing. And I understand the First Amendment. I understand guns rights activists, but like, we are in such a dangerous, horrible spot with people using guns to kill people without any sort of regard for human life. Like, I would never choose to be a part of that discussion in a way that glamorized it again. I didn't mean to glamorize it. I mean, it was a Vice documentary. That's how it was shot. I thought it was good to sort of feel next to him. You know, it is sort of reminiscent of my other work. A lot of this is about sort of moral ambiguity. Is this wrong? Is this right? Guilt, innocence, things like that. It really set me up to have these discussions. But, you know, I feel pretty strongly that we are in a bad place with gun ownership laws in America.
Mm. And it sounds like you kind of have over time had this moment where you realize like maybe the effect of some of the images you create might not end up being what was originally intended, or may be taken in a way that you didn't intend, or in ways that are out of your control. Is that fair to say?
When I'm directing things and working with institutions like Netflix and HBO, no, like if I do have creative control over like what gets put in there, and I especially because I'm the one that's deciding what gets shot. But I think that I don't know how I'm going to feel about things 5, 10, 15 years, knock on wood, if I'm still living. And so I think it's when I'm choosing a project now, it's like, do I want this to be a part of, you know, if I'm using an institution like HBO, does this subject matter lend itself? Am I doing more good than harm? Am I putting more evil out into the world than good? I think that it's all of these sort of ethical debates I have to have as a filmmaker as I, you know, sort of pick my spot.
Yeah. So let's talk about like how you choose your projects. Your work is so diverse and you cover so many different topics. I'm curious, like, how do you decide what to work on? Because these projects can take months, if not years, to complete, right?
Always years. Yeah. To be very clear. For documentary filmmaking. Yeah, I think that it's kind of like a formula that I have now for work, and I'm happy to share a part of it is, you know, I have lieutenants that are looking for things that feel like something I would be interested in. It always has to have a technological component. It has to be multi-layered. I think a lot of crime stories, unfortunately, are pretty linear. And I think the only way to get it on, you know, networks are, you know, is it not about the crime, but is it about this sort of societal question? And, you know, is it about loneliness? Is it about suicide? Is it about obedience, power shifts? Is it about how we relate to one another? And so I practice, it's called an elevator pitch. And when I'm considering working on a project, it's, you know, can I explain it to you, David, and are you going to ask me more questions about it? If someone just says, that's cool, don't do it. No one will watch it. There are too many things out there. No one will watch it. And so it has to pass these sort of set tests. It has to pass my own tests. Then it has to pass the network tests. And then it has to pass like the, can you actually get access into the story test?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people maybe don't apply those tests. Like they find something that they're passionate about and then they follow it, but they don't necessarily think through how to sell the documentary or how to get it seen, right? And it seems like you have that as a key part of your decision-making process.
Yeah, I think that I need to acknowledge that I'm coming from a very sort of privileged spot of I've, you know, worked very consistently for the last 6 years. I pretty much always have a project and I have never, I don't spend my own money on my documentaries. I make sure that they're funded. Now that's, you know, that's ridiculous. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, everybody had to basically make their own documentary and then sell it. And so, you know, I'm very cognizant of what networks like. I have to watch a ton of stuff, things like that. You know, it makes me, I am pretty commercial in terms of my work. Like if you sort of think about Mommy, Dead and Dearest, that's not going to be winning an award at Sundance, you know, but it is going to be talking about mental health and about sexuality. And it's going to like sort of hit these buttons that that people want to talk about. So I think that I have made a consistent effort to think about what about true crime is commercial, but also how do we elevate it? How do we elevate the genre so I can continue to have sort of ethical discussions? I want to hide philosophy into these sort of commercial doc projects. So I think that it's just about understanding how the industry works and that it's really hard to option a documentary. You can option written pieces. And I think it's important for journalists to have their pieces optioned. Like, I think that, you know, I think that it's, we're in this media bubble. It's really difficult. Why not vouch for these amazing long form pieces that can end up being TV shows? I think it's like, in terms of holistically, it's like, it's a very good step forward.
Gotcha. So, but I think what you're saying is that, like, you can have a written piece about a true crime story like Dee Dee Blanchard and Gypsy, and that can easily be optioned to become a miniseries or a movie. It's harder for that to happen to a documentary, you're saying.
Well, yeah, because HBO owns my documentary. Is a production company going to go to the behemoth of a network and say, we want to option this documentary? I mean, there's so much more loopholes. And we're getting, like, inside baseball here. But I think that, you know, there will be more and more options on pieces because there's more and more content being made. And we're basically at the precipice of the streaming war with HBO Max and all those things. So it's going to be a wild couple of years.
Right. And that puts documentary filmmakers, it sounds like by implication, at a disadvantage because once you gather the story, you have to put together a film about it, which is, some might say, harder than writing a piece about it. Right. Like,
well, it's not, I mean, basically if I were to do what most documentary filmmakers and, make it and retain all works, and then you can basically sell the scripted rights to a different company, then you can really, you know, make some serious change. But yeah, making a documentary is insanely difficult, I would say. And, you know, a documentary is only as good as your editor. And that's what people sort of tend to forget. I think a lot of directors, like I'm speaking to you, but the huge sort of chief strategist of all of this work has been a guy named Andrew Kaufman, who cut my first three films. And like he, you know, we together are responsible for this sort of trilogy of sorts. And so I always want to throw my hat in the ring to remind people, it's like, it's very easy for me to talk about these things and scripted adaptations and my feelings and all that stuff. But it really stems from like a creative process of writing with a editor.
One question I had for you, Aaron, is before we dive into I Love You Now Die, I'm curious about your overall documentary or documentarian inspirations. Like, are there any films or filmmakers that you're particularly inspired by or that inform your work in some meaningful way?
I love documentaries. I love watching them. I love thinking about them. I try to watch as many as possible. I mean, early, you know, big loves in terms of figuring out how this worked was definitely Alex Gibney, who made Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, Client Number 9, WikiLeaks, which I bought, you know, I mean, this, so he's a, I'm sitting in his office right now, not his actual office, but the place that his company works. And it's just, he's just like this incredible force that continues to make thoughtful, intense, probing documentaries. And like, I love how unabashedly like he makes them and people are like, oh, Alex Gibney makes too many films. And to which I say, like, you know, that's just because people can't keep up. He's been a huge inspiration. And then there's a filmmaker, Liz Garbus, who made the seminal film, There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane, about a Taconic Steak Parkway crash that happened. And it was a crime story, and I recommend everybody to watch it. It's on HBO. You know, it's about what happened to that mother as she drove the wrong way with her children in the car. And then it morphs into this meditation on motherhood. And what does it mean to try to attempt to be the perfect mother? And it just haunts me. I've watched it like 14 times. And then my other one is Capturing the Freedmans by Andrew Jarecki, which is the guy that made The Jinx. And it is one of the most intense, crazy films about a nuclear family exploding due to a pedophilic sort of scandal that happens with the family. I don't know. All these are horrible and dark, but they kept me thinking about it.
As you're listing these movies and these filmmakers, like, what are aspects of what they do that you've tried to incorporate into how you approach things?
When I was making my first film, Thought Crimes, I watched, I think, a documentary film every single night. And I just immersed myself into the craft. And we're talking about like Steve James and Frederick Wiseman and, you know, all of these sort of are the legends in the craft. Because I didn't go to film school. I didn't have a complete education in documentary. But here I was, and I was making one. And I wanted to figure out how to do it. And so when I think about making these things, I have this awesome book called Tell Me Something, and it's advice from documentary filmmakers. And it has all this great sort of funny, weird, specific language just for this art of documentary filmmaking. So when I'm in production, I try to meditate on a page of that. And because I'm always so stressed during shoot days, it's so much money. I'm interviewing everybody. I have to get it right. I have to make people feel comfortable or uncomfortable depending on the interview. And I hate the aspect of actual production, and so many real documentary filmmakers love it. So it's always been a bit of a challenge to sort of psych myself up for this intellectual sparring match.
Well, you said you hate the actual production. Like, what is it that you don't like about it? Just how stressful it is, or is there something else?
I have worked on things that are painful. And so when we're talking about I Love You Now Die, which is about a young woman that texted her boyfriend to kill himself amongst saying many other things. I interviewed a lot of Conrad, the young man, his family. And it was just, you know, they were scarred. They were in so much pain. It had been a couple of years. And I found the whole process to be painful for me. So I can't imagine what it was like for them. And so, you know, there was a ton of like, it was the camera at the trial for Michelle Carter. And there were so many technological components that I didn't exactly know how to do it. And then I would have to chase after people. And I really felt like a vulture. I felt like this weird kid, like begging people to talk to me. Like I was always sweating. I like everybody else like looked fancy. And like, you know, there was 20 people there. There was Nightline and like they all had like heels and blazers. And I was like carrying a, you know, a tripod and like dripping sweat. I always felt like even on my third film, like really like JV squad, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Even though you are making movies for HBO, right?
Yep. I don't know. I think the imposter complex like lives inside us. And during these like high intensity moments will come out. But it's like, I think that why I continue to make stuff is like, I can withstand that pressure. Oh, I had a bad day. It was really difficult to do this. So what? Like, fuck off. Like everybody has hard days. And I'm lucky to be doing it. So I think that it's just, you know, it's an exercise in like showing up and yeah, continuing to do it.
One thing I'm curious about is how you conceive of yourself as a character in your films. For instance, like on some occasions, you can be seen or heard interacting with your subjects. And I'm curious how you approach that. I think like it was more evident in Mommy, Dead and Dearest and the At the Heart of Gold movie and less so in the Aaron Lee Carter documentary. But I'm curious if like there's something conscious about how you include yourself in the storytelling, or is it just like, oh, I included myself because I had to, because otherwise you wouldn't understand the context of the answer that the subject was giving, or what are your thoughts on that?
I like that you just called it the Aaron Carter documentary. Wouldn't it be so cool if I made an Aaron Carter documentary?
That's actually my project I'm working on. This is the first step in that.
I don't ever put voiceover in the film. I think that there's some people that do it and do it really well. I have tried. I'm not one of those people. And so when you hear my question, I think that there's definitely a reason for it. I am in service to the audience. I am a proxy for the audience. Potentially the questions that the audience wants to hear or answer next. I see myself as a translator when I'm talking about, you know, what went wrong in the USA gymnastics scandal, or, you know, what Michelle Carter was thinking then. It's really, you know, it's really about what is happening next. And I'm an investigator in the film. And I think that it feels pretty crazy though to like be a documentary filmmaker and get messages on Instagram saying like, you're my favorite documentary filmmaker. And it's like, isn't that a bit of an oxymoron? Like, I just think it's this crazy, weird social media age where like people now know my films because I have worked on them. And a lot of people have said, I've watched all your things. And then I realized you did all of them. So it's been a little sort of weird to think about, but I have a lot of gratitude for it, for people watching it. Cause it might have been difficult to get people to watch things, you know, a while ago.
Yeah. And it sounds like you kind of conceive of yourself as the audience's portal to the story that's being told. Right.
Right.
One of my favorite documentary filmmakers is Errol Morris.
And yeah.
He's very much like who got me into loving documentaries in the first place. And he, I feel like, has very much become like a character in his documentaries. You know, like you often hear him from off screen and you hear him interacting with the subject and he often just leaves that in the film. And I always find that to be very fascinating because it's really, it's in those moments when this real life interaction is occurring between the documentary and the subject that you do get like a little bit of insight into the person. And on that note, you were saying like one thing that's very challenging is getting people to feel comfortable. You're asking people to bare their soul, and particularly like watching At the Heart of Gold about the gymnastics scandal, it's like, and also, I mean, really all your movies, but watching that movie particularly, I was acutely reminded that these people, like dozens of these women, are reliving one of the most traumatic elements of their lives. How do you kind of approach talking to them about it, both psychologically and practically? Like, how do you approach this very challenging task?
I worked with a trauma-centric therapist to talk through what are the ways of approaching this that does not cause more harm. It felt really important to me as somebody who has made true crime films to not have that exact protocol that I've done on previous films with the gymnastics film. It had to be sort of very different. And so my whole mode was when they get to set, we go and we sit away from the cameras. I talk them specifically through what we're going to talk about in the interview, but I say the things that you're not supposed to say. You are in control. We can talk about what you want to talk about. We do not have to talk about what you do not want to talk about. I will ask you a question and you don't have to answer. It really is about what feels right to talk about now. And I, you know, as that would have been inconceivable that I would have told somebody that you don't have to answer my question, because they're, the whole reason why people answer these questions is they're in front of you. They feel compelled. There's a societal reaction that, you know, people are supposed to talk back at you. And so there had to be a dramatic shift in how I interview people. And honestly, it really was like working with a team, watching every victim impact statement, understanding the scandal from the inside out, figuring out what role each person would play, how to make them feel like they were carrying a certain part of the story versus just a voice amongst so many voices. I mean, it was so intellectually and emotionally difficult to figure out how to do that the correct way. And some days I did better than others.
Mm. Well, I think you did a lovely job, and the film At the Heart of Gold is very compelling watching, and I'd recommend it to anyone. So I think your work paid off in that regard. Is there something you do for like self-care after something like that? Like, you've just exposed yourself to all these horrifying stories and you need to like process that and like get the word out about them so that, you know, people can take notice of them. Like, but I imagine it must take a toll on you as well. Do you have like tricks to like self-soothe as a result of that?
Yeah, I've gone through really weird health problems in the last 2 years, and I'm not a woo-woo person, but it's crazy to think about that I took in so much trauma. And now my body is sort of freaking out. And I have this like weird orphan lung disorder. And it's like, that's not really a coincidence. And so when people talk about how glamorous my job is, it's like, you know, it's fascinating. It's I wake up every day ready to do more, but it does have its toll. And so like self-care, I don't know how you do self-care when you're working on three different things. I just got a dog, which is a huge step for me because I've wanted one for 5 years. And I was too worried that I couldn't take care of the dog. I would prioritize the movie over the dog. And it's like, there are so many idiots with dogs. I'm going to be fine. I have two sisters that can help. I have, you know, I just spent the morning looking into my dog's eyes. It was the best, truly the best thing I could have imagined doing with my time. And like, I'm going to be a good dog parent to her and it's going to be fine. But yeah, it's been a weird couple of years.
Let's talk about I Love You Now Die, the Commonwealth versus Michelle Carter. How did this story first hit your radar?
So I was working on finding sort of technological inspired crime cases. I was developing a series for HBO in which Mommy, Dead, and Dearest was going to be an episode, and I thought Michelle Carter would be an episode, but the stories ended up being so much sort of bigger than an episodic format that we broke them out into feature films. And I was always hunting for stories, and I saw a headline in the Washington Post that said, "It's now or never." And it was this picture of Michelle in these like really open, intense eyes. And I just was like, what? That doesn't make sense. Like, I don't know why someone would say those things. There has to be a bigger story here. And so I started working on it in 2015, and it was a really difficult one to crack because it was an ongoing criminal case and people couldn't really talk. And so I had to sort of stay on it for years thinking about it. And then it was the huge coup was that we were allowed to be the camera inside the courtroom for the trial, because typically news organizations will be something called a pool camera, but news organizations shoot it a very specific way, and that's not the format of a documentary. So we were able to film it with my cinematographer, Brian Sarkinen, in the way that was like long takes, big wides, not just focus on Michelle, focus on the prosecutors, focus on the witness. And so it was just this thing that sort of, you know, very, very carefully and very slowly came to be.
How were you able to get that permission? Like, is that permission granted to many parties or is it just one? And how were you able to get that permission?
I mean, they probably really regretted it. It was, I was working with my co-producer Allison, and we asked the, basically you asked the PR department at the Commonwealth of Massachusetts if you can be pool camera. And, one of the worst days of my entire life was day one of the criminal case. And, basically you have to, if you're the camera inside the courtroom, you have to relay the feed back to other news stations. That's the whole process. So it was like, we got a converter, we got all this, you know, this hardware, we set it up, and it like wasn't working. And it, it was opening statements. The pool wasn't going, the pool wasn't going through. I just started to drip. I thought it was like blood out of my eyes because people were so, so mad. And I asked this one guy, like I turned to like the veteran in the room, and I said, I need your help. If you could think about why the pool camera is not relaying, what would it be? And he was like, it could be a million things. I was like, what is something I can solve in 15 minutes? He was like, you know, I think that it's the it could be the extension cord, that it's like not the right voltage. And I like, okay, I was like a Hail Mary. I prayed to God. I was like, please God, help me with this. I don't know if you exist, just help me. And it was the converter. It was that. And it ended up relaying back, and everybody was like, you know, like fuck this HBO lady. And they didn't know it was me, 'cause I was like wearing a baseball cap and like braces. And I'm sweating right now just retelling it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds horrifying. So what camera were you shooting for the actual film, I Love You Now Die?
So that was an FS7.
I see. So I think, you know, for those who are unaware, my guess is, and I don't know, but my guess is that the FS7 does not shoot in a broadcast format, or it needs a converter in order to be broadcast format, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like news organizations can't just take the feed directly from an FS7. They need it to be converted, and that's the difficulty you ran into. Once that occurred, you were fine from that point. Once you fixed the converter.
No, the second day, we also had technical problems. And so basically, they were like, throw these people out. They're idiots. And I was like, this is a glitch. It's going to be fine. And I had to hold my, I had to hold the line. And we figured it out. And the next couple of days went pretty smoothly. I think it ended up paying off. What I wanted in this film was not just a ton of text messages, but I really wanted you as a person watching it to live inside the courtroom, like you were sitting inside, because, you know, Michelle Carter did not get a jury trial. She opted for a bench trial, which means a judge determined her fate. And so I thought here was this incredible moment where the documentary could, you know, could serve as a part of the jury that she never got.
Right, right. And also like part of the public record of how people remember this trial. When you're thinking of tackling the trial portion of this film, I noticed that your other movies also have significant sections that take place in a courtroom. Were you also the in-court camera for those movies as well, or did you get footage from other people? Like, how was the courtroom footage experience different for this movie?
I feel really grateful to the United States criminal justice system, not because of how they do their business, because it's horrifying and that's why I'm making films, but there is a certain level of transparency in certain states. So when you see Mommy Dead and Dearest, that's a lot of our footage inside the courtroom. When you see At the Heart of Gold, we had a camera inside that courtroom. There was many other cameras, but we got a very sort of great documentary specific vantage point. You know, I think that for me, trial footage is a foundation. It is something that people always like looking at. I think my films are a bit too talking head heavy. I think there's a lot of people that are explaining things to you. And so I find that as I do these peer screenings, the footage that really does well is inside the courtroom. And people can just sort of sit there and take it in and think about it. And so when I'm deciding to work on things, it's like, is there courtroom footage? Can I be the courtroom footage? You know, I think that it's a really special sauce element to making documentaries.
One of the things that's challenging about courtroom footage is the fact that cases often last a lot longer. These things can often happen for months. So like, are you shooting every single day? Do you kind of understand implicitly at this point what days it's more interesting to shoot?
I mean, as a documentary filmmaker, you have to shoot everything that you have access to. You never know what is going to be helpful in the edit. There are things inside that movie that I was like, I can't see that. And so that's why you work with somebody that challenges you. You know, I think the films would look very different if I was editing them because I have bias. I've met these people. I care about these people. It's important that whoever is cutting it doesn't, you know, doesn't have that same level of sort of empathy. I know that a lot of documentary filmmakers edit their own films. I am just not one of them. And I think that I think that's fine. And it works for me, but no shade on people that edit their own films. Cause maybe they're able to distance themselves better than I am. Yeah. I mean, these stories like just live inside my skull. I dream about them. I think I get up and think about them. I talk about it. You know, I had an ex-boyfriend that with time, how long it takes for me to bring up the cannibal cop and that he wanted to conspire to rape and torture people. He was like, you are just heinous at a cocktail party. you know, so it's just like, you know, it's a weird move, but it's fine. I don't know where I was going.
In I Love You Now, Die, you were not able to get access to Michelle Carter. Like, she did not agree to an interview. And I'm curious, like, what were the challenges of telling a story where you didn't have the involvement of one of the main subjects of the title of the documentary? And how do you approach telling that story?
Yeah, so I think that that's a really good question. My first film, Thought Crimes, I had access to the guy in question, Gil Valley. The second film, Mommy, Dead and Dearest, yeah. I had exclusive access to Gypsy Rose. And here I was, hands out, with nothing in return. Michelle Carter, I asked her about 17 times. I asked her family. I asked friends. I'm somebody that works with access. And so here I was with piles of footage, and I didn't have her voice. And so I really saw it as one of the biggest creative challenges that I faced as a filmmaker. Anybody can make a good film with access. If you have the person, it's really hard to screw it up. The fact that we were able to put together a portrait of someone we never sat down with, now that's a magic trick. And I think that that's when I really gained confidence that, you know, we know what we're doing. And, you know, it really was because of the text messages. Here we had records of thousands of text messages that our subject sent to not just Conrad, the person in question, but other people, her friends, her family. You know, and I think that it really went to her state of mind. Who is she? What is she thinking about? What does she care about? What does she like to talk about? And so the way that it was rendered on screen was for you as a person to really think about her and think about, you know, sort of her pathology and what she struggled with. Because when we hear what people have struggled with, it's really hard for us to render them completely as a demon or as an ice queen. And that was sort of that was the whole reason to make something like this, to add a new layer of understanding to her as a person.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the great things about the documentaries you make is that many people often only see the headlines or the general concept of, you know, this woman told her boyfriend to kill himself. And like, that's all they see. And I love how your movies bring more detail and complication to these people's lives. They invite you to accept these real life figures in the fullness of their lives and all of the things that involves. So one of the most challenging aspects of a tech heavy movie is representing things like texting on screen. And I'm curious, we've seen various representations of texting, you know, in many movies and documentaries and so on. How did you arrive at the solution that you arrived at for this film, which is essentially like, I'm trying to describe it, it's like you see the person's name and then the text with its original syntax and then the sound effect of sending a text on an iPhone. And that often is overlaid with like B-roll footage or B-roll photos. How did you arrive at that kind of solution for representing this technology?
Yeah, I think for some, it may have been, you know, some might say it's too simplistic, but my sort of whole creative process was, I want you to feel like you are inside the phone. We get text messages all the time as a matter of course, And so I wanted it to feel like you receiving that text message or you being inside that conversation. And sometimes we do it on black screens. Sometimes we do it, through a slow-mo, beautiful nature footage. But I think it was really understanding that these were two people communicating in a vacuum. And that's what I wanted for you to understand, that there's just so much loneliness and so much intensity to the text messages. And I've seen the film 80 times, and it's hard to see those text messages because at a certain point, I think I was showing it to somebody. I was like, are there too many text messages? Like, is this painfully boring for you? And they're like, no, it is astonishing. Like, I can't forget that the first time you see those, they're pretty crazy. And so I really wanted to sort of keep them as a central character.
You spent years of your life working on telling the story of Michelle Carter and Conrad Roy. I'm curious if there's one thing you want people to take away from this documentary, I Love You Now Die, what would that be?
There's basically this testimonial, these videos that you see in the film of him talking into camera, talking about struggling with social anxiety, with, you know, mental health issues. And it's just this, he's so handsome and he's so smart. And it's just this really amazing picture of him. And then when I was showing it to Lynn Roy, his mother, I was showing the film to her at HBO, she told me that, you know, those files were in the trash can. He never uploaded them. They were never a part of something he could actually say out loud. It only existed in his head. So when you think about this film, yes, think about Michelle Carter. Yes, think about free speech. But think about people who are struggling to just say things out loud. And is there a way to communicate with the men in our life or, you know, the young people in our life about, like, you know, mental health stuff is not a stigma. It's okay to have social anxiety. Almost everybody has it. And so I think it's like, it's about reaching out to the people in our lives and understanding that, like, suicide is a real thing that people think about. And you think somebody's fine until it happens. And so for me, it was an education in, like, that suicide, you know, is something that a lot of people think about. And if we can just hold a couple of people back and say, you won't feel like this forever, you know, that is my real hope.
Beautifully spoken. Erin Lee Carr, it's been so much fun to talk to you today and so informative to learn about your process. Erin Lee Carr is the director of multiple documentaries, including At the Heart of Gold, Inside the USA Gymnastics Scandal, and Mommy, Dead and Dearest. She's also the author of All That You Leave Behind, a memoir, and her newest film, I Love You Now Die, The Commonwealth versus Michelle Carter, is available on HBO. Erin Lee Carr, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, David.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Weekly Recommendations. It's the weekly segment where I recommend something I've been watching, reading, smelling, drinking, whatever. This week, I want to recommend a book. It's called Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End by Atul Gawande. I have been meaning to read this book for a long time. It came out a few years ago, but I finally had a chance to get to it during my recent vacation. And this book is excellent. I would recommend it to basically anyone. It essentially covers what happens at the end of our lives and what our values should be. It asks us to consider, like, when you are getting to the end of your life, what are the things that are most important to you? Because our current medical system is primarily designed to prolong life as long as humanly possible. And it doesn't necessarily ask what the quality of life you might want is. And what this book, Being Mortal, Medicine, What Matters in the End, does is it causes you to consider what it is you would value if you were in that situation, what it is you'd value if your parents were in that situation, if your loved ones were in that situation. I think in American society, it's really uncomfortable and to some degree socially unacceptable to talk about things like sickness and death. And what ends up happening is people make suboptimal decisions because they don't have all the information they need to make the right ones. What this book encourages you to do is think about having those conversations earlier because it can often lead to a better outcome. Short-term discomfort now can lead to a much better result later, and this book makes that point wonderfully. I would strongly recommend it. Again, the book is Being Mortal, Medicine, and What Matters in the End. definitely check it out, because aging is something that happens to us all. Death is something that happens to us all. And the more open we are about it, I think the better off we'll actually be. And on that morbid note, that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of Culturally Relevant. Again, you can find more episodes of this podcast at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Email me at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. This episode was edited and produced by me, David Chen, as well as Sean Michael Fox at fspodcasts.com. And it was powered by Simplecast. If you are looking for a solution to start your own podcast, check out Simplecast.com. They offer lots of great features for any aspiring podcaster to use. That's it for this week on Culturally Relevant. We'll see you next week.